Yeah, any problems there? So if it's 5 minutes per point, by the way, so if eight points, so it's for each group, you've actually got 10 minutes, haven't you? That's clear. But we'll see how you get on. If you can do a meditation for 4 minutes. Where's that from? So any points from the discussion of the homage so far, please ask, or any points you've got in general. It's probably a good time to ask questions. If you have any. It's all making sense, is it? Well, we'll go through the verse and then check through what it says on the outline paper to make sure everything's in order. Yes? The way the introductory verses goes is like this. The first verse is the homage. Okay? Then verse 2 and 3, we can say they're the purpose. The purpose for the composition of the text. So don't include those in the homage, ideally. We say that's a separate section. Verse 2 and 3, the purpose. And then the very condensed summary is in verses 4 and 5. So that's basically giving you the 8 clear realizations, right? The 8 chapters. And then the slight expansion of that, so the more extensive summary, where you get there's 70 points, that starts on verse 6 and finishes on verse 18. So verse 19 is where the first topic of the first chapter begins, which is bodhicitta, mind generation. So that's my understanding. The first topic of the first chapter is bodhicitta, so that's mind generation. So, who is Maitreya bowing down to? Down to the mother of the Buddha, and here at Bodhisattva company. So the mother of the Buddha is the perfection of wisdom herself. We had the visualization, we haven't specifically officially talked about it, but you've got the description on your outline sheet. So when you like to visualize her, then as in the picture kindly provided by Mark, was it? Did you provide that? Thank you. Did you paint it?
No,
did he? Well, that's very good. Well, it's very suitable for today. Yeah, thanks a lot. It's she's described by our scholarly expert, or one of them, Brunel Holzel. She's described as a female deity, yellow in colour, sitting cross-legged, four arms. The first left hand holds up a text, first right hand a flaming sword, and the remaining two hands in the gesture of meditation. But if you look closely at Marx, I think you'll find instead of the flaming sword, you've got a Vajra standing upright. Anyway, I think it still represents the same things. If those hand signals represent the three wisdoms, there's wisdom of study, hearing, that's the first wisdom arising just from hearing the teachings and getting the words straight. Or we can say the same word as study. The word they use for hearing also means study, oral tradition. Then contemplation, and finally meditation. Contemplation is where you've reasoned about the thing, you've decided whether it's correct or not, so you've got a firm ascertainment of the subject. And then familiarization, you really have to make that part of your mind. You really have to get a direct, clear, strong habituation to it. So how is that represented by the hand gestures then? By the hand signals? Venerable One. It's written on the paper also. I'm reading from the paper. The outline, Geshe Gren's Basic Buddhism. Handout one, general outline, da 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 da, on the last second, bottom of the second page. So you've got three hand signals and three wisdoms. How do the hand signals represent the wisdom? Text is study. Yeah. Does that sound all right? Yeah, so hearing and study, that's hearing and study, you need the text. Contemplation is the sword of wisdom, it's the sword of reason, you see. Kind of cutting away false ideas and so forth, but the Vajra is also a kind of a similar kind of instrument, isn't it? And then meditation is the hands on the lap. In the posture, that's the mudra of meditation, isn't it? There you are. So that's a feature when we describe the perfection of wisdom as a mother. And then we get a kind of a breakdown from the mother in general to specific three types. So the first type is the knower of all, and that immediately requires a cautionary remark. It's not really on that outline yet. Okay, so the knower of all, it means the knower of all bases. So the knower of all is also commonly known as the knower of bases. So this is one that's associated with hearers. If you call it the knower of all, that's fine, but you tend to get it confused with the knower of all aspects, which is the one that is associated with Buddhas. So you've got to don't mix those two up. Knower of all, which we will, from here onwards, refer to as the knower of bases, just for clarity, knower of all bases, that is... the one in the continuum of, the one that is, typical, the one that abides in the type of being a hearer, hearer path, hearer type of realization. Yes. And as we know in Tibetan, an established, not in Tibetan, in our debating language, an established base, that simply means an existent. So another word for existing thing. So here base means, doesn't mean like support or cause. Here it means something that is a base, something that is established by valid cognition. So that's the same as meaning it exists, same as it's a phenomenon, something that is known by valid cognition. So think of base in that sense. And it says all bases then, but what it basically means is the Four Noble Truths. You know, what does a person who is meditating on the Hero Path mainly meditate on? Yes, well, they mainly meditate on the Four Noble Truths. So when they come to the truth of the path, they're not meditating on this lack of true existence of, you know, the Bodhisattva speciality. They're meditating on their own speciality, which is this knower of understanding of personal selflessness. So that would be their knower of paths, you see, of the four different noble truths. That's the antidote. That's the one that is the main meditation to purify away all their negativities. So that'll be their meditation on personal selflessness. So this will come up in a minute as we review these topics, these terms. But just to give you the idea. So this is the mother of Buddha, the mother of the Buddha, you see, who as the knower of all, so that's one of her manifestations or something, one of her types, one of her particulars, you know, one of her instances, is she who leads the hearers seeking peace to utter peace. So we've described their approach now, haven't we? And so the peace is the peace of solitary liberation. So it's a peace of just freedom from suffering. And they achieve utter peace. Utter peace in the sense that they won't be shifted from that peace. They don't have to go back to cyclic existence. It's just a sort of complete freedom. So a complete separation from suffering. So people who make that their goal, that motivation, they're the hearers. But we'll just go through quickly and then we'll recap all these points just to make sure. So then the mother of the mother also is in the another instance of her, another form she can take, another type of wisdom is as the knower of paths. So she, as the knower of paths, make those who work the good of beings achieve the world's welfare. So who are those? Who are those people who have the knower of paths? Who are those who work the good of beings to achieve the world's welfare? Yeah, the Bodhisattvas. So anybody who's alert can immediately see, well, what's happened to these shadowy characters, the solitary realizers? Well, they mentioned that they're supposed to be understood implicitly. They're also people who are seeking peace and going to utter peace. So they're implicitly included without being mentioned in the first couplet. So describing the foundational path. So don't worry about those for a minute. So yeah, the knower of paths, that's the Bodhisattvas. You see, because they are trying to help other beings. So it's not just they want to know their own path, which is the Bodhisattva's path, which is meditation on true existence, absence of true existence, and you know, performing the fantastically strong meditations on compassion to give fire to that their wisdom realization. It's, you know, it becomes really sort of, you know, intense thanks to their meditation on compassion, and their meditation on emptiness gives real power, gives real sort of, you know, incisiveness to their meditation on compassion. They really understand how people are suffering, where they're coming from. So that having understood emptiness correctly, you see, so they really know where people are kind of getting fused, confused. So the imagination and compassion becomes very strong. They're really well informed, and they really sort of feel strongly. So their compassion grows and grows, you know, in tandem with their wisdom. So each of those are supporting each other. So that's their personal path. So that's maybe we should mention that point. You see, they say that when you're meditating on an ultimate truth, absence of true existence, then only emptiness can appear to your mind. So it's that kind of phenomena that, say you're meditating on the absence of true existence of pot, or the absence of true existence of house, or the absence of true existence of any phenomena, or the absence of true existence of yourself. The conventional object won't appear to your mind. You'll just absorb into emptiness. This is at the stage of direct realization, you know, the superior's meditation, when they're doing their meditative equipoise. So you just absorb into that emptiness so fully. It's completely different from meditating on any other object, they say. So it's like your mind is mixed with the object, like water poured into water. So you're directly realizing the fact that this phenomena has no existence from its own side. So you're just realizing its actual reality, its deep reality, that it isn't founded on anything, that's just its own uncommon way of existing. So there's no way no way it exists in its own sort of by its own unique nature. So everything then has to be posited by the valid mind that's engaging with it. So that's sort of such a radical realization, revolutionizing the way we normally come at phenomena. So this is the real sort of profession of wisdom, ultimate level. So we haven't really done a meditation on this today, but the point is that once you're in that state of deep meditation on emptiness, then no other phenomena will appear to your mind. You're looking at reality. So all phenomena like conventional truths, pots and pillars and so forth, they don't withstand the analysis. So there's nothing that ultimately there for a pot. There's nothing ultimately there that is a pillar. So the object that you're observing and realizing the emptiness of doesn't remain when you realize its emptiness. See, if it did remain, it would mean it had some ultimate reality, but it doesn't. Only the emptiness, only the complete absence of any ultimate reality, that's the only thing that's appearing to you. So the conventional phenomena drops away. So then you can see, you understand from that the bodhisattva, however skillful they are, they can't meditate on emptiness and bodhicitta at the same time. Because once you're meditating on an emptiness, it's sort of engulfing. It's like it just draws your consciousness so deeply into this sort of special realization of no ultimate truth, which is such a sort of mysterious negative phenomena without anything, positive appearing, just a complete absence of this mode of abiding. So the bodhisattva doesn't meditate on emptiness and bodhicitta simultaneously. That's the point. When he arises from the meditation on emptiness, then he can meditate on compassion. So then he can turn his mind to, if things are really like this, now we really understand the confusion in the world and so forth. So then he meditates intensely on the compassion and determination to become Buddha. Become Buddha needs this huge collection of merit from the sort of practices of the other six perfections. The other five perfections, the perfection of wisdom, but then in the state where you're focusing on conventional phenomena, conventional truths, then the other five perfections come into play. Do we know what the six perfections are? Can you rattle them off for us?
Generosity, patience, concentration,
think that was right, wasn't it? But not in the right order, but never mind. Yeah, they used to put morality first, you know, on the basis of good morality, then you can have, you know, a clear enough mind to meditate. And so morality should come first, and generosity is a sort of one of the early ones, patience, then enthusiastic effort, and concentration, wisdom. Is that six? Yeah? Anyway, we'll get a chance to come back to those. So all I'm saying here is just to remember that the bodhisattva can't meditate on compassion and wisdom at the same time. They can only meditate either on ultimate truth or on conventional truth. Tantric system might be a bit different, I don't know. And a Buddha can do both. That's the one feature of the Buddha. You see that until you reach Buddhahood, you know, you can't see ultimate truth and conventional truth as being exactly the same nature. So they're not a different nature, the same nature. The emptiness of pot and pot are this just same nature, like pot and the impermanence of pot. But you can't make that appear to your mind until you're actually Buddha and got rid of your subtlest obscurations. So let's just say that the way the Buddha Bodhisattva is working, they have to meditate first on emptiness, then on compassion, and each one reinforces the other. Each one gives sort of heat and intensity to the other one. So that's the Bodhisattva's own path, but you see, at the same time, they'll be teaching the other people who are taking a lesser path, like the hearers. So they need to know the hearer's path, so they can teach it to the hearers. And then, of course, any other people who need help, they need teaching in a different way. So the bodhisattvas are their special type of wisdom, their special type of path is called Nara paths. So that's another aspect of the mother of the Buddha. So at the time of the bodhisattva, of course, we're not saying that is the actual perfection of wisdom. We said that's the causal perfection of wisdom. Yeah. So we're making that distinction now. The perfection of wisdom proper is only on the Buddha ground. But this is, you know, an aspect of the causal perfection of wisdom. So that's the description of the Buddhas. So this Nara path is what makes, what enables, what causes those who are working for the good of the world, or working for the good of sentient beings, achieve what sentient beings want. So they want freedom from suffering. Whatever they want at least higher rebirth in psychic existence to avoid the lower realms. You know, the people with small scope, they need to know how to do that. But ultimately, everybody wants to be completely free from suffering, of course. So they're teaching people how to get out of suffering and to achieve the best that they can achieve. So that's the second one, knower of all, knower of bases. So the second one, knower of paths. And the third one, and well endowed with whom. So this is the third variety of, third kind of the mother, and this is knower of all aspects. So that's omniscient mind, omniscient consciousness. So you're familiar with Buddha having an omniscient mind, knowing all phenomena. But in this ornament of clear realizations literature, they tend to translate that sort of a name a bit more literally and say, knower of all aspects. But it means omniscient consciousness. Aspects, you know, what's the difference between an aspect and a base? Well, it's kind of, you know, tricky. There's no real difference, you know. Every established base, every phenomenon is an established base. And then the aspect is supposed to be the way that object arises to mind, you see. The aspect means the way an object is taken into mind. The appearance of an object in a mind, yeah. So, but all objects will appear to you, the Buddha's mind. So, again, it just refers to all phenomena. So, I'm not quite kind of come to the bottom of why, you know, why don't they say the knower of all basis for the omniscient consciousness? He knows all phenomena, but no, it's got to be the all aspects. So we just have to go along with that. So what do we say about varieties? I don't have anything to say about that. The varieties of all aspects.
Aspects
Yeah, if you remember we talked about aspect, you know, is the way the object is taken into the mind is like, you know, if you're looking at a cup, we can say cup is the object. But then doesn't your mind have to be generated in the aspect of the cup? The mind takes on the aspect of the cup. Just like, you know, if you hold a cup up to a mirror, the mirror will take on the aspect of the cup in the sense there's an image of the cup appears in the mirror. So it's just meaning that. So that's clear, and the mirror image is clear, isn't it? You know, and Aristotle, doesn't he say when he's talking about perception, he talks about the king's signet ring and the warm wax, so that the pattern on the king's ring is transferred to the wax. So his image of consciousness, knowing an object, is that. You know, the consciousness like is like the wax that takes on the impress of the object. So that's all we mean. You know, the consciousness is taking on the aspect of the object. So, but why is that? You know, all consciousnesses do that. So why make a special use of the word aspect here? I can't figure it. But I think variety, the varieties of all these aspects. So that means, I think the Buddha knows, you know, all of them. He knows the Buddha, the Nara bases, he knows the Nara paths. He knows everything about, you know, that he needs to know for his own purpose. So the Buddha is, you know, knowing all those varieties, all the different teachings, which reveal all the aspects of all the paths, of all the vehicles. So the sages, that's the Buddhas. That's another word for Buddha. It's like in Tibetan they say tuba, like able one. So it's some sort of a Sanskrit word. What's the Sanskrit for that? Shakyamuni, Muni it says, isn't it? Muni. Shakyamuni Buddha. Muni is the word that in Sanskrit, I think. Shakya is the clan, Buddha's clan. That's his you know, family name. And Muni, the sage of the Shakya clan. That's how Buddha is referred to, this to identify the Buddha of this era for us, our world, our wheel-turning Buddha. So sage is some word like that, implying the wise being. So that's just simply the Buddhas. So through having the mother of the Buddhas, you know, having the perfection of wisdom in their continuum, fully perfected, the actual, you know, fully qualified perfection of wisdom, so then they're able to teach all beings, you know, whatever their inclinations, whatever their predispositions, whatever their problems, he's able to teach them all clearly. So that's his unique feature. So that's why he needs to get to Buddhahood, in order to have that ability to teach everybody according to their need. We're all ready to tea break, according to this. Gosh, time's passing today. We've been late in the morning, late in the afternoon, haven't we? Getting back from lunch. Well, that's gone through the verse. You can back that up then with your handout one, which has got that information in a sort of condensed form. So this is how the yogic middle way autonomy school presents the three vehicles and the four superiors. So that's a condensed kind of a review of that, just to provide the core structure of the grounds and paths. I'm sure you'll find a bit more in the handbook, in the introduction. So you'll find some little charts and so forth in there. But I've just put the bare bones in place. You see, then gradually can fill that in as we go through the weekends. We can get sort of divisions in between, you know. So the vehicle divides into five paths. We mentioned the path of seeing, that's one of them. So each of those hearers, solitary realizers, bodhisattvas has five paths. And then within those five, there are significant divisions. And then we've mentioned the six perfections. So that's, they're all six components of the bodhisattva's path. They don't apply to all the vehicles, they just apply to the bodhisattva's vehicle. You see, so by the end of it, you know, if you go through all the divisions and gradations and aspects there are, your head will be completely spinning. So I don't know how many, I can't remember how many different divisions and divisions and divisions This gentleman, Brunholz, has gone and counted them all up, you know, so there's probably thousands of them. And he's the man to count them all up. So I'll leave that to him. So there's probably a bit more I can say, but might as well break for tea. Okay. Let's have a little bit of time before we do our meditation then. Well, is there much to set up? I thought we would just sit and turn and face inwards. And then we'll be able to hear each other's voices, hopefully. I mean, you could sit in a circle, but we might just sit like this as we are now for the first few minutes. Because we're not going to spend the whole time doing the meditation. So let's have some tea. Please get your refreshments. Well, let's say 15 minutes. We've been a bit late today. Cut it 5 minutes short. Yes, that would be nearer, wouldn't it?
Yes, so thank you very much. But it seems he's happy and he fits neatly. 50%.
Yeah. Good.
Ruth looked much better.
Yeah, I saw her just then.
So glad. No,
yeah, she seems to have got over her.
Well, she was tired and then having that.
Yeah, one problem after another.
Well,
she's bounced back, hasn't she? Yeah. Well, somebody's getting me one, I think.
Oh,
I hope so. Yeah. If they don't, I'll whack them with my mala. Yes.
Excuse me, I missed the first part of the. I wanted to ask you regarding. You mentioned you say the three levels of suffering, right? Suffering, change, or pervasive suffering. May I ask you regarding the pervasive suffering? I don't really get my head around it in terms of. What is it?
Yeah, well, it's a good question, and not one that's so quickly answered. But do you read Tsongkhapa's great treatise on Lamrim? Have you read that?
Yes, but I'm not that well. Very short, not as well. I cannot really say that I read it or studied it.
No, but that's a good place to read about it. So it's in the section on suffering. Then they get further divisions of suffering. You know, the sufferings, divisions of suffering to six and eight and so forth. So I think it's one of the last ones. So you find it in there. But you have to puzzle it out a bit, what he's saying. So, first of all, in terms of what it covers, that really all suffering is included within the pervasive composition of suffering. Mm-hmm. So the other two, the suffering of suffering and the suffering of change, in fact, are just varieties. Mm-hmm. So all suffering is the suffering of the composition of phase, and so it's just like saying all of cyclic existence is included in there. So it ranges, includes everything that's in cyclic existence and not. I mean, of course, the Buddha comes down to earth, you can say he's in cyclic existence. We don't mean that he's more pervasive composition of suffering as soon as he gets to touches his feet on the earth or anything. But, you know, if somebody's meditating on directly on emptiness, which you can do even if you haven't, even if you're not on one of these paths, you can still meditate on emptiness. Possible, you know, before you develop renunciation, you've got to realize emptiness. So that realization of emptiness, I think, you know, or at least that's something that's leading you out of cyclic existence. So, don't we call that all pervasive composition suffering, but everything else in general, you know, even the objects and environments of cyclic existence. So it doesn't just cover the minds, it doesn't just cover the feelings, it covers the everything, the mind and the objects it's looking at. And you know, all the different aspects of the mind that are doing that looking. And well, basically they are pervasive composition suffering because they are sort of involved with, or you know, caught up in affliction and karma. Mm-hmm. So that's how you know it's the truth of suffering is. It's got amongst its causal collection, it's got affliction and suffering. So the cause of suffering, obviously that's what gives rise to suffering, the truth of suffering. And then when they give examples of it, they just say, you know, afflictions and contaminated karma. Mm-hmm. So anything that's produced with them in their cause, then it will be unsatisfactory. Mm-hmm. It will be limited. It will be, you know, give you the... If it does give you happiness, it'll only be that limited happiness of samsara.
Happiness of these lives, of course, is imperfect as a result.
Yeah.
Mm. As well.
Yeah. So it's even a slight imperfection is an imperfection. So although some states of samsara might be quite fulfilling or, you know, rewarding in some way, still they are. Doomed to go out of existence, or can only be temporary. They get swept away by the hand of the inevitable, you know, decay of impermanence. So anything that has that trace of, you know, samsaric imperfection, that's unsatisfactory, and so that gets included in composition of pervasive suffering. And the way some people explain it is. So that's all the aggregates, five aggregates, and the outer and inner. So the way some people explain it is suffering of suffering is like easy to explain. Everybody recognises that as suffering, even animals can be very sorry when their, you know, offspring gets killed or taken away to be slaughtered or something. So mental, physical. Suffering of suffering. The suffering of change comes through the understanding of impermanence, gross impermanence, you know, just manifest impermanence that again you can see without having to be too much of a meditator or anything. You can see the flowers fading in the end of summer, and you can see your loved ones dying, and you can see, you know, sudden illness and disaster and so forth. So that's the suffering of change, that even if it's happy in cyclic existence, it kind of, you know, has no ability to sustain and can be cut off at any time. So thinking about gross impermanence, you can see worldly happiness as being, you know, in some sense suffering. And then you get at pervasive composition suffering, you make that arise to your mind, I think, by meditating on subtle impermanence. So it's not just sometime at the end of, you know, sometime, you know, death will come along and carry me off, you know, sometime in the future. It's bound to happen, which in itself, you know, disquieting. And, you know, if you keep remembering that, it's, you see how unsatisfactory cyclic existence is. But with subtle impermanence, you see, you're remembering it, it's like every moment you are just getting nearer to death, every morning, every moment you are, you know, in this constantly disintegrating flux, as that writer said on the first day. That's how he described it, you know. And the sense of Matthew Arnold's poem, you know, everything is just sort of like the tide is constantly going out. It's not like in one day in the future it's going to happen, this bad thing, which is gross impermanence. But it's like, you know, it's constantly going that way. It's always getting nearer. Death is always getting nearer. So everything you're doing is like, you know, it has tinged with the sense of... contaminated, you know, with the sense of like it's not going anywhere except towards ruination. So then, when you understand that clearly, then you can develop a real renunciation from samsara. You forget about any pleasure in samsara. It's just sort of, you know, the process of decay is unfolding. So you have to meditate. You realize subtle impermanence. So you can get a very strong sense of that. Then you can say you've got a chance of understanding. Pervasive composition of suffering. So, where are you from?
I was born in Moscow, but I grew up in Berlin, so from Germany. Lived the last half year in India.
You moved around then?
Yeah, but
yeah. What's your name?
Matvei,
that's a Russian name?
It's Russian. It's like Matthew in English. India, that's a good
name. Pardon?
In India, that's a good name. I do that, Shala.
Yeah. Okay, are you getting a cup of tea? Or not bother? Yeah.
Do you want one?
I thought somebody was bringing me one, but they obviously have not.
Which tea did you order?
Just ordinary tea.
Green tea?
Ordinary tea, which means black tea.
Black tea. Okay.
With milk.
But your homemade Russian pierogi.
Russian? You better give it to Matvei then. Russian pierogi.
You know, did you eat them?
Sure. Never heard of them.
It's like a Polish dumpling, basically with cheese and mashed potatoes. They're very good, very tasty. So I was thinking, on your way, if you want, maybe on the travel to eat or something.
Will they last till tomorrow? I put them in the fridge. Yeah.
Where shall I put them? In the upstairs in the fridge, or?
Yeah, why not? There's a pile of my stuff in there. Put them in there. I don't know what we're doing tonight, but.
Do you want to go?
Is it? His birthday, okay. Well, we'll see. And my first priority is to go for a walk. Which I've arranged with Steffi, but doesn't mean anybody can come, you know, it's not like... But we'd be doing that for an hour or so first. But after that, I don't know. I don't know if... Mike maybe have some ideas, but maybe not. Probably not, really. So, we'll see. Yeah, that's fine.
Do we consider this the ornament of clear revelation as a commentary? It is like the original teaching of the Buddha commented on, expanded on Dharmakaya, or how do we...
Yeah, it's a commentary on the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. Some people say it's a commentary on all, the condensed, middling, and extensive Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So the condensed one is 8,000 lines. The middling one is 25,000 lines, which is this one is 18,000 lines. So it's pretty similar to the one we've been reading. And then the extensive one is 100,000 lines. So that's about 12 volumes, a huge thing. So it's... ideally people like to think of it as a commentary on those three. So yeah, it was explained to Asanga by Maitreya, because Asanga was puzzled, he couldn't understand it properly. Thank you. Lovely. So that was the purpose why Maitreya taught it to Asanga, so that Asanga could understand the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. No, this is being Sanskrit. So we think about 600, 700, 800 years after Buddha passed away. So Buddhism is sort of flourishing in India, going strong really, and then this is like a new wave of enthusiasm for the... We've had the teachings of the foundational schools, the individual liberation schools were strong after Buddha passed away. Yeah, what you could call Hinayana. And then along comes Nagarjuna and say there's a much profounder way to understand, and that can... The motivation is everybody should try to become Buddha who is able to, Everybody's got the Buddha nature, so we all can become Buddha. So he's teaching the Bodhisattva path, but he's mainly concentrating on this Madhyamaka radical emptiness. So that's another wave of popularity of Buddhism in India, or another sort of style of Buddhism. And then Asanga comes along, two hundred years later, and he's producing a kind of Buddhism which is feels more available to the masses, concentrating on the Buddha as somebody who works in the world for the benefit of beings, not somebody who's just sort of razor sharp and emptiness, but more committed to the welfare of beings. That's his path, to help beings as much as possible. And then with this slightly less radical mind-only view going along with that. So that's a third wave of popularity of Buddhism in India, in Sanskrit, you see. Then as that begins to reach its peak and becomes institutionalized, or lose some of its vigor, or then the Muslims start to invade. So then the late masters of that tradition, they start to take Buddhism up into Tibet. So one of the best commentaries on the Ornament for Clear Realizations is one by Haribhadra. So it's called the Clear Meaning Commentary. So that was composed by Haribhadra. So Haribhadra was a disciple of Shantarakshita. And Shantarakshita was the first Indian monk to go to India, to go to Tibet, and found a monastery. So he founded the Samye Monastery. So that was, that's when it starts to all happen in Tibetan,
So, Buddhism just sort of doesn't have continuity in India itself. What happened directly
after? Yeah, maybe there's a resurgence of Hinduism, Buddhism loses its fashionable, and then the Muslims come along and they devastate large areas of northern India, burn all the libraries. Is it time to ring that bell? Well, there's a bell out there, isn't there? Well, there might be another bell. Is it the fire bell or another bell? Maybe I should go to the bathroom. So we've gone through the first verse, just roughly anyway. Probably a lot more things can be drawn out of that, but that'll do for the time being. So you just have to know those other terms now, knower of bases, which confusingly in the actual verse it says knower of all, but those two are the same thing. Knower of paths, and then knower of aspects. Sometimes they say exalted knower of all aspects. So what are you ready for now? Are you getting tired? We can go on a bit further. Or maybe you've got some questions, because we haven't had much time for that today. Everything clear, is it? So what isn't repeated?
Sorry?
What isn't repeated? Yeah, I think in Sanskrit it's actually Buddha is a singular, I'm guessing, because the people who are translating, the learned Brunholz and Gareth Sparham, they say the mother of the Buddha. So you get the idea for the last line, the images of the Buddha of our era, Tishi Shakyamuni Buddha, one Buddha, a single Buddha. You know, in Tibetan you can't tell if it's singular or plural, so the FPMT translation says Buddhas, but I wonder if in Sanskrit that's not actually Buddha. So you have the image there of Buddha sitting on Masvasa mountain and the teaching platform, surrounded by the people listening to him, you know, just our Buddha, one Buddha. But that's for what that's worth. Yeah, so he's bowing down to the mother of all four superiors, if you include the solitary realizers. It takes three different forms, so three different types of knower, one for each vehicle.
Solitary realizers, are they only able to appear when no teaching of the Buddha exists?
Well, they have to have teachings, don't they? So they must appear, and they must get teachings.
But in previous lives?
Yeah, so when... I don't know, in their last life they make a wish or something to appear where there's no Buddhas, so they get they're reborn in a place where there aren't any Buddhas or hearers.
So it wouldn't be possible for a solitary realizer to exist now because Buddha's teachings exist?
Well, that's not the only time, but it said in their last life they appear like that. Well, I think they have to have the teachings of the Buddha to learn what they're supposed to know. But it's in their last life that they make their prayers to appear in their last life in a place where there's no Buddhas. And their final part of their journey in their last life, you know, that's when they work without having a Buddha or a teacher. Is that okay?
So it wouldn't be possible for a solitary realizer to exist now, having received teachings in a previous life. They would only be able to appear somewhere where no Buddha's teachings exist.
Yeah, but how long are these last lives? I don't know. Are they just talking about the ordinary length of life of ordinary being? I have ideas of these people being, you know, having extraordinary long last lives somehow, you know, and just being hidden away in places. So there could be times in their past life when there are Buddha's teachings available. But it's all a bit, you know, the references are very few, so I don't know detail, I'm just speculating. You came across him in the sutra. But did he give any detail about what they're actually...
Well, I'm just saying four different kinds of Buddhist actions. So, you know,
Yeah. Yeah, so nothing terribly informative then. Well, we haven't had much time to meditate on this absence of true existence today. We've missed a bit of sessions, but we can't do everything anyway. We can save that till later. People are not too tired, I don't know. We're going to do a meditation, aren't we, anyway, so that's going to be quite a long one. So we can have to leave that. But I guess by, you know, next weekend in October we'll be getting into the fourth chapter. We've still got these other verses of the introduction to do. And I think we should do a good examination of bodhicitta, which is the first of the topics of the first chapter. If nothing else, we ought to study that one, because that's such a sort of a key issue. And there is a sort of grand presentation of it in the Perfection of Wisdom literature. I don't say there's anything amazingly, you know, new after you've studied bodhicitta and Lam Rim teachings. I'm not saying there's vital new information, but yeah, we should have a look at that, definitely. So, not so much longer on these preliminary verses or the first chapter. We're getting on to the fourth chapter. But I'll see. There's a lot of interesting stuff, really, in the first chapter. You know, after you go, if you're studying it in the traditional way, after bodhicitta, you get this what are called the instructions. So you hear about the Sublime Mother, as taught in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. You read the first verse, you know, and then either you just have direct faith in the Mother, or you establish her existence through reasoning. So that's when you get taught your preliminary introduction to absence of true existence, which is, you know, what how the Svatantrikas, the autonomists, are interpreting, you know, the message of the emptiness of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So you study that. So you establish emptiness, and through various stages you establish, therefore, that the Mother, Perfection of Wisdom, does exist. You know, so then you have faith based on reasoning. You know, clear faith based on the proper understanding. So then when you've got that, then you generate bodhicitta, you see. So that's your first step towards making progress towards your goal of Buddhahood. Generate bodhicitta. And then, which includes renunciation, of course. You know, you've got to have a complete understanding of suffering in order to wish the people to be free from it. And then you start on progress. So the first thing is instructions. At that point in instructions, you get instructions on two truths, four truths, three jewels, three objects of refuge. So these are all subjects which are studied in depth at that point. You know, we'll have studied them a little bit in teachings you've gone to here and there, and things that you've studied in your earlier classes on the collected topics. But actually, to study and debate about those obviously key central topics like two truths, four truths, three jewels, and so forth. They all come up in this right early on in the first chapter, you see. But the official program is that we're doing the fourth chapter. But you see, all these topics keep coming up again and again. See, there's loads of stuff in the fourth chapter about the four truths. So there's no problem about fitting them in somewhere else. So I think we can, once we've done bodhicitta, we can just sort of flow on to the fourth chapter. Although the Buddha nature topic, that's another one that's kind of a fascinating topic. So that's really in the first chapter. So I'll have to look if it sort of comes up in the fourth chapter, so we can sort of digress onto that in the fourth chapter if we want to. That's an interesting topic. So we'll see. I'm just trying to look ahead, you see. We're not going to see each other for another month. So we're just speculating. Anything that you want to concentrate on, or any sort of particular hopes that you have from this course that you want to express, that I can take on board? Not too, been too difficult so far, then. Yeah, well, you've got a month to think about it now. And don't worry, as I say, you'll find if you start opening even this handbook prepared for the FPMT, you know, you start looking at that. Never mind learned texts like Runal Hots or whatever it's called. And you look through the verses of the perfection of the ornament of clear realizations, you know, what sense can you make of them? So you find a lot to put you off, sort of thing, but don't let it put you off. We're only going to be selective. We're only going to do the bits that will be useful to us. So, as I've said, that's not, don't worry too much about that. Yes? Are you talking about, which text are you talking about?
What?
The handbook.
I'm talking about the handbook.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, because I imagine we read this, we read the handbook, but the handbook is the one that we should be trying to understand. And is there a particular text that helps us
Well, I mentioned the difficulties in the on the reading list, didn't I? To find something which presents it in a digestible way. So I think this introduction to the handbook is the best bet for you so far. But yes, there's a lot of terms still to learn. So you just have to be patient and wait till we come to them. And then when you're reading other Buddhist books, you'll find, you know, you'll get some sort of hints about what's happening, some sort of information just here and there. But yeah, there's not a lot to offer. There's if you find anything about, is there a good text that anybody knows about grounds and paths in English? Good explanation of the Bodhisattva's paths and all these, the five paths from the path of accumulation to the path of no more learning. Yeah, I've not seen that one, but that's always a useful one. Is there one specifically on grounds and paths? Isn't that one? I thought that was one I'd looked at. I don't remember there being a lot in there, but I may have just forgotten. Quite possibly, yeah. So, Essence of the Heart Sutra by His Holiness would have something about an explanation of the paths. That's possible, yeah. Because if you explain the Heart Sutra in a more detailed way, you can relate that to the five paths. So that'll be helpful. You've got that, have you? And then if you're going for a more, you know, more sort of doorstopper of a book, there's Meditation on Emptiness by Geoffrey Hopkins. So if you look in there, you know, that's like a Buddhist encyclopedia too, see. So you'll have comments about how the hearer makes progress and how the Bodhisattva makes progress on the different levels and steps they go through. And, you know, the different types of realization and conceptual realization, direct realization, you know, all those things we started to talk about. You'll find them in there. Just look up in the index, search around. But I say you have to look around. You know, you have to wait. You know, it's that kind of a subject. You have to do your own bit of research. Yeah, but Meditation Emptiness is the book that I used, you know, learning, hearing all this in Tibetan and thinking what's going on, and all this is gigantic kind of layout of all these different things. So at that time, fewer books were available, but his, Jeffrey Hopkins was the one you could go for and sometimes get some hints from, you know, some little quick explanation that at least got you sort of in focus. Yeah, oh well, it's almost 4:15 then. So we might as well do this meditation, eh? Say no more. Practice. So if you turn yourselves around, or your cushions around, I don't know, to face each other, and then I'll come and sit here, I think, and then we can all hear each other. I can hear what kind of what you're doing without the use of the microphone. I hope you're not going to speak yet.